market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that desperately wants to believe that the pollies are doing it all for the right reasons, but is finding it bloody hard. I'm Andrew Page, and with me, Mr. Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools. It must be almost budget time.
That is the clue in that little teaser there.
But we're sure there's going to be something else to talk about.
There's always stuff to talk about in the land of money.
Shall we then?
Shall we? Let's talk a bit about media. We talked about 10 last week.
We did.
They're in a bit of trouble.
It's not getting any better, either.
And now Fairfax.
Yeah.
Well, Fairfax has been doing it tough for a while, but the journos are on strike. What does that mean? We're going to talk about the banks as well. A couple of them have come out with their earnings. And of course, it's an increase, but a little bit soft there. So is the party over? And we're going to talk a bit about iron ore, everyone's favorite metal. It's
really?
I don't know.
Iron is a girl's best friend, as they say.
That's what they say. It's why my wife is so lucky with her iron ring. Is it time to buy, though? Last time we had a big plummet, turned out to be the case. Well, we'll talk a bit about that as well. But let's start with Fairfax, shall we?
From the sublime?
So, the sublime to the ridiculous. We talked a bit about 10, as I said last week.
Yep.
Shares there down, what, 99% or something crazy from their all-time high.
Yep.
Look, the last 10 years for Fairfax hasn't been wonderful. I think, on average, you probably would have lost close to 10% per year.
Yeah.
Having said that, the last little while has been okay. Shares are up 27% in the last
even
year.
A dead cat.
Even a dead cat will bounce. We've got to talk about some of these share market sayings in a future podcast.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And that's one of them, and as bizarre as many of the others. But it has come back a little bit here. But Fairfax announced a series of cuts. Not the first and maybe not the last either. In fact, I think they're getting rid of, a quarter of their...
25% of the newsroom.
Jeez
across
Louise.
The country. Yep.
Now, they've kind of got to do something, right? You're bleeding red ink.
Yep.
It's always preferable to just improve the top line, but they're having a hell of a tough time with that. So you've got to cut some costs.
And here's the thing. Not only are Fairfax cutting costs, but Channel 10's newsroom is rumoured to be being taken over by Sky News. Of course, Rupert Murdoch owns Sky News and is a major shareholder in 10 through Lachlan, I believe. Mm. There's a very decent chance that 10's newsroom is also going. So you think about, one of our three big free-to-air networks, one of our largest newspaper businesses, and in both cases, frankly, old media isn't paying and news is being cut as a result.
Yeah. And from a certain hard-nosed financial perspective, it makes sense, right? There's just not the money there. You've got to cut costs, right? If you don't, you're just going to be losing more and more money and you're going to be forced out one way or the other. The trouble is, of course, is that when your whole raison d'etre is to produce journalism, if you don't have the... And journalism, I think it's a pretty fair, unbiased comment to say that journalism has the quality has deteriorated. These journos are under more and more pressure to produce more and more content, more and more quickly. And it's just really, really hard to do. It's particularly things like investigative journalism and the rest of it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the average quality has fallen as more fluff has come up. I think there are still some really high quality journos. So I wouldn't want listeners to think that we're saying that the quality journos are doing worse work. No, what we're saying is on average there is simply less quality journalism going around.
And it's harder to do quality journalism well.
Now, we should say we have relationships with both Fairfax and Sky News. So we've mentioned both of those. So both of us are contributors in different occasions to both those news outlets. So fair disclosure there.
Well, we're doing our part, mate. We don't get paid for that. So you're welcome.
Yeah. Look, so here's the challenge to your point. Look, back in the day, there was, the newspaper survived on classifieds. The journalism that they did was kind of almost a loss leader, right? They kind of did this journalism to fill the front third of the paper.
Yep.
So the classifieds, the cartoons, and the sport could do the rest.
The rivers of gold.
Exactly. Yep. The classifieds, rivers of gold. Now that's gone away. Seek, realestate.com, carsales.com.au. There is so many other places now those classifieds go. Mm. Other than the big real estate lift outs, the big glossy color photos, that's pretty much all the classifieds that are left in the mainstream, metropolitan newspapers these days. And so Fairfax is looking at their business saying, well, how do we keep, costs of printing are going up.
Yeah.
Journalist costs are going up. Staff costs are going up. Everyone wants a pay rise.
Sure.
And yet you've got a scenario where simply fewer people are going to those metropolitan papers because you don't need it for the classifieds anymore. And there's so much other free news available.
Yeah.
The challenge for Fairfax is to stay relevant.
Yeah.
Now, Ten, on the other hand, similar problem. Viewers are going somewhere else. There was a time when everybody on a Sunday night sat down and watched 6 o'clock news.
Mm.
We all watched one of the three major channels. We got our news from the same places. We got our entertainment from the same places. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, The Simpsons took Channel 10, so I'm not sure about number one, but certainly amongst its main demographic, that 16 to 35-year-olds, did spectacularly well.
Yep.
Now, all of a sudden, kind of, we go everywhere else for our media, whether it's Netflix, whether it's YouTube, whether it's, you know, whatever else we want to go and find our stuff. And so, Ten, as the third of three commercial networks in terms of viewership and ratings, is really struggling to get enough revenue, I should say, to cover those really significant fixed costs.
It's really tough, isn't it? So the business model has to pivot here. And there's really, sort of broadly speaking, there's two kind of models here. One, it's still free to access. Besides buying the paper, free to access the Herald or the Age or whatever online.
Correct.
But they get some ad revenue from that. So again, it's all about attracting the eyeballs as well. This is really sort of depressing when you look at your outlook for humanity. But you know what works when it comes to eyeballs? It's stories of UFOs. It's stories of Kardashians. It's all of the real gutter kind of stuff. But that just works, right? So that's what they do. So there's that model. The other model is a subscription model. And I guess a third one is a blend of the two, which is kind of what a few of them do. But as you say, it's hard to get people to open their wallets when they can get this news source, this news from so many, a variety of different places. So what are they, I'm going to make you CEO of Fairfax.
You hate me that much, dude.
Good luck with that. the poison chalice. What would you do?
Mate, I'm glad I'm
put you on. I put you on.
No. The honest answer, I don't know. I mean, I have immense sympathy for the journos who are saying we're trying to do our best work here to keep politicians honest, to keep big business honest, to be the voice and the conscience of the society, the fourth estate, as
fourth
it's called.
Estate, yeah.
You know, it's a really necessary part of functioning democracy. So,
but you're there for shareholders. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it. You're not there for democracy and society. You're there for shareholders,
which is exactly the problem. And that's why in the past, journalism has flourished on the back of those classified revenues. Mm. The problem is that there are fewer viewers who pay for Foxtel than people who watch free-to-air TV.
Yeah.
There are fewer people who pay for subscription newspapers versus those who simply buy it because they want the classifieds or the sport or the whatever.
Yeah.
In terms of, we're, at the end of the day, we're all very selfish people. And so we all might say, it's like the Made in Australia thing, right? You ask people, do you want Made in Australia? 90% of people say yes.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to what they actually buy,
I buy the cheap stuff.
Holden's closing down. Yeah. Ford's closing down. Pacific Brands, who made Bonds undies and other things, went overseas because people said they wanted to buy Australian made, but never actually did.
Yeah.
So you got this real big problem. Here's what I would do. I would have a high quality subscription paywall service for those who would have wanted to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have a clickbaity front end for those who didn't. So taking the Sydney Morning Herald, we're in Sydney here. I would say, right, let's make the front end. If people want to click on those stories, then who am I not to give them to them?
Right.
I'll do that.
Yep.
But for those people who want the quality and who will pay for it, then I'll give them that part of it behind the paywall. And I'd almost have, a bit of Jekyll and Hyde, two parts of the business. You blend it, of course.
Mm.
But the reality is I would keep the stuff people want to see, the really kind of attractive stuff at the front.
Mm.
But also, too, you need to pivot the types of people. You look at the BuzzFeeds of the world who have done a blend of super clickbait and some good quality journalism stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the combination of that, Mark DeStefano, for example, their politics guy, does a really good job of making it really attractive, easy to read, easy to understand, but serious political journalism. I think that's the future, is keep it entertaining, keep it enjoyable and engaging, but also make those serious points. That is going to be, I think, the future of journalism. If it's going to survive as a quality news source, it needs to be done in a way that gets people's attention, makes it worth their while reading, but also keeps them entertained at the same time.
Would you suggest that it needs to become more niche focused as well? I think the AFR, the Australian Financial Review, is a good case. And that's actually doing relatively very well.
Yeah.
In the sense that, we pay our subscriptions for that.
And it's expensive.
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
What do we pay? Like $600 a year
or
something like that?
Might have been more than, I think.
For that's the hard copy and the and
digital.
Access for digital.
Yep.
But it's very focused. It's for the investment money kind of nerds and people who are prepared to sort of pay for that. And they kind of own that space. So is that a strategy as well? Just to really, do you break things up into, this is the sports portal. Mm-hmm. This is the business portal.
Which is kind of what's happened with classifieds, right? To your point before. I struggle, Andrew. Journalism only kind of, so on a public policy perspective, journalism only works when lots of people read it. If only 45 people who really, really desperately love it read it and pay a fortune for it, you don't get the benefit for society of that quality journalism. So to your point, as a shareholder, probably that's probably the strongest answer.
Yeah.
frankly, I think the hardest part with that is that it undermines the very role of journalism in keeping the bastards honest, quite frankly.
Okay, last question on this and we'll move on. Fairfax Media, ASX code FXJ, buy or sell?
I don't get to hold.
Yeah, you can hold. If you've got some shares, you can get rid of them. You can buy some more.
If it was up to me, I would say I think Fairfax is a speculative buy. Let me put it out there.
Speculative buy.
And
okay.
The reason is, I think if you're a punter, Domain as the real estate business has some significant value,
that's
possibly worth up to almost the entire market cap of Fairfax.
Yeah.
So if you separate those businesses and say this is a journalism, print media, old school business plus an online new age real estate portal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the combination of both together is reasonably potentially attractive. There's big downside. So the reason I say speculative is there is a big downside risk. If they screw this up, it could fall by 50-75%. So this is not one for the faint-hearted. Yeah. It's not one of our recommendations for exactly that reason.
Yeah.
But I do tend to think it might possibly have a chance of doing well because, specifically, ironically, because of the non-journalism part, the Domain part is relatively attractive.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best case you can make. For me, it's probably a sell just because I kind of tend to put it in the too hard basket. Yeah. The turnaround play is always a tough one. So there you have it.
Cool.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go to banks.
From the sublime again to the
right. So banks now, this is a sector that, unlike media, is just, for so long has been doing so incredibly well.
Yeah.
Plenty of people out there held shares put in the bottom drawer for a long, long, long time and just made squillions and squillions and squillions for a whole bunch of reasons we probably don't have time to go into. but ANZ and NAB released their half-yearly results throughout the week. And it was a little bit soft. Market was a bit disappointed. We actually saw shares pull back a little bit. Of course, it was another case of record profit, but the increases weren't as much as people were expecting. Yep. And this is an interesting one. Banks are always very controversial. But you're looking at companies here, both of them, like dividend yields, 5% and 6%, both fully franked. That's really, really, really attractive. That's got to be tempting, doesn't it?
It's a really good question. I mean, for the banks, this is a story of, the past and whether the future looks like the past. The past has been unquestionably spectacularly good. Mm. And it's been driven largely on the back of house price increases. And you said we won't go into it. We won't go into too much detail. But effectively, banks, the combination of a very cozy oligopoly with very few players and a decent amount of pricing power is part of that story.
Yep.
Part of the story is they took over the little guys. So the Bank Wests and the Wizard Home Loans and the Aussies are now part of the big guys. And frankly, the house prices have just gone through the roof and are continuing to do that. So that's underpinning the growth of these guys.
Mm.
The challenge is that those things can't continue. And so the question is, what does the future look like?
Not at the same pace.
And I think that's right. And I think that's the key challenge. If you can only grow your profits at a couple of percent, despite the fact that house prices are growing at double-digit rates, there's something to say, when this party stops, it's going to be very, very hard for the banks to continue. The hardest part for ANZ and NAB in particular was they call them net interest margins. Without going to the horrible gobbledygook on air, net interest margins is the amount of money left over after all the bills have been paid.
Is it, you could say, the difference between what it costs you to borrow money versus what you can lend that money out?
Totally. So, they take term deposits at 3%, lend it out at 4%, the difference is 1%. That's kind of their net interest margin.
It used to be the old saying in the banking industry, 3-6-3, borrow at 3, lend out at 6, and on the golf course by 3. Something like that?
That was the good old days. That's the story, right? The interest margin is the difference. That's actually been contracting. So despite the record growth in house prices, despite effectively record low interest rates, the competition for the banks and their funding sources, those margins are being squeezed. And that's the hard part. If you think about despite that growth, they're getting margin squeeze.
Plus, they need more capital requirements too, from a regulatory standpoint.
Yeah,
that's got to make their profitability a little bit harder.
I don't blame anyone for having banks in their portfolio. We've recommended NAB in one of our services, an income focus service, as a very small part of a portfolio. That makes some sense. But I have to say, I think most Australians, particularly older Australians, and I don't mean to insult anyone here, but if you've been in the market for a little while, you bought the banks that at the listings, or you had them for a while, the average Australian portfolio, I think, is something like 45% banks.
Yeah.
And so that's a really, really enormous risk. I think I'm not outright expecting calamity for the banks. I'm a bit bearish on their ability to beat the market over the next 10 years, I have to say. But no matter what, if you have 40% of your portfolio in one sector, you are taking an enormous amount of risk. That concentration is just simply not smart, quite frankly. And I get why people say, well, I could have said that 10, 15, 20 years ago, and that's also true. But if your job is to make sure you have a decent retirement portfolio, not take any unnecessary risks, I think having a concentrated portfolio with the banks as the very, very large core of that is a very unnecessary
they
risk.
They all share. It's like having 40% in the one company, isn't
right,
it?
Right,
you
right, right.
You know, different though they are in parts. You know, this is the thing that's I think I've mentioned before on the podcast. For me, it's not about trying to predict an imminent collapse or even a slump, but it's that asymmetry of possibilities, in the sense that maybe we just continue to muddle through for the next 3-5 years, and it turns out I get a decent yield, you know, a little bit of growth, and everything's great. But that's kind of the best case scenario.
Totally.
And the worst case scenario is, well, you know, maybe there's a slump in the housing market, you know, business lending dries up even further, et cetera, and then you really get, you know, some potentially big downside there. So
I think when Sydney and Melbourne house prices are up 15-18% and you're getting 2% growth in profits or 2% decline in profits, that tells you exactly where the risk sits in terms of future returns. Is there's no possible way house prices continue to grow at that sort of rate. And if they don't, how can banks maintain the current level of profitability, which is already pretty mediocre in terms of growth, if house price growth is 5 or 6% rather than 10 or 15? It just doesn't make sense.
Okay, so it's a pass on the banks.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's talk about the federal budget. Federal budget is coming up next week. It's going to capture a lot of media attention, except from Fairfax, because they're going to be on strike. But everyone else is going to be covering it.
Yes.
And I guess understandably so. It impacts a lot of us. But probably you would argue all of us to varying degrees.
Yep.
We know uni fees are going to go up. We know that private school funding is changing.
Mm-hmm.
What else are we on the lookout for here? I guess more so from a financial perspective.
Totally, from an investor's perspective. Look, the question really right now is we don't really know what to expect. And the big changes, I guess there's a couple of things that have been big hot button issues right now. The first for investors specifically is what happens to negative gearing when it comes to housing. And so we generally invest in shares, the Motley Fool. We know many of our listeners probably have investment properties. When it comes to how properties are taxed, that's a big question that may or may not be resolved at the budget. There's every chance, based on the commentary from Scott Morrison and Malcolm Turnbull, that it won't be changed.
I can't imagine it will be.
But that's
political suicide, surely.
Well, maybe. Then again, they changed the private school rule. So, I don't think it's likely, but again, it's something to be careful of. The second thing that's being highlighted for investors is the capital gains tax discount. Now, if you've held an asset for more than 12 months, you only pay tax on half of that gain. Effectively, investors say, well, it's half the tax rate, which it kind of is effectively, but the official rule is half the gain. So if you hold an asset for 12 months, you make $100 profit, you only pay tax on half of that profit. So half of the profit effectively is tax-free. The rest is taxed at your marginal tax rate. So that's a really big discount for investors. Cost the budget a lot of money, quite frankly. And so there's also concern about, you know, is that necessary for investors? Is it required? Will that be changed? That's the second kind of consideration and watch out for the budget. And then just more generally, I think that the risk or the potentially opportunity for investors is what happens more broadly across the board with the way taxation is levied. So things like deductions and expenses, that kind of stuff. So thinking about the broad mix of policy. What do they say? What's the jargon? I won't bother. The policy settings. That's what I was trying to say.
Policy settings.
Just for investors,
levers
think about
and
dials. There you go. Think about how that might work and not work, and just, you know, keeping an eye on that. So negative gearing, capital gains tax, and possibly stamp duty. They're the three things I'd be looking out for. There has been talk for property investors about some sort of national approach to a house vacancy tax. Is the last one. So again, those are the things I think. I don't think any of them are necessarily likely, quite frankly.
No,
but they're the things we'll be watching out for when it comes to the budget.
Let's play what ifs.
Yes.
Let's say they do. Let's say they do change some of these things. Your capital gains discount is reduced. You can't negatively gear anymore. Does that really change how you sort of approach investing?
It doesn't change how I approach investing, but many investors should think again about how they are approaching their investing, because for a lot of people, the tax becomes a central component of what they're doing. In fact, many investors ask about the tax first and the returns after that, right?
Isn't it crazy? I've had people in the past complain because their shares went up a lot now I have to pay a lot of tax. What does Buffett say? Send them my way. Let me unburden them.
Exactly. You know? If you're someone who hasn't gone ahead with a great investment idea because of the tax he might pay if he's successful, send him my way. Let me unburden him. In other words, you know what? If you make $100, you got to pay $25 in tax max. It's a nice problem to have, right?
Oh, like, great, better than the alternative. You can lose a bunch of money and then not pay any. In fact, you get a tax credit.
So here's the thing, Andrew. If I offered you $1 million profit and said you had to pay a quarter of that, $250,000 in tax.
Yep.
And they changed the rules tomorrow and said, actually, no, you can only have the $1 million if you pay me $500,000 in tax.
I will still take Of course. I won't be happy about it, but it's better than the alternative, right?
The accountants listening to this right now will be very familiar with this. People don't walk into their office and say, can you please help me maximize my after-tax return?
No, no, no.
People walk into the accountant and say, can you just help me pay less tax, please?
Yes.
Which is just, like, honestly, it's the dumbest thing. I get the human nature part, right? Yeah. Kerry Packer famously said that, you know, the government isn't spending it so well that people should be donating extra. So I get not paying more tax than you have to. But walking, if you listen to this now and you go to your accountant tomorrow, next week, next year, or your financial planner, please do yourself a favor, do them a favor, and don't walk in and say, how can I pay less tax? Walk in and say, how can I maximize my after-tax return? That
matters.
Is the only thing that
money
matters.
Money in the pocket. Indeed, yeah, indeed. Absolutely.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Jeez, man, the time has just raced along. We haven't talked about iron ore yet, so let's dive into iron ore. Iron ore.
Your favorite metal.
My favorite metal.
A metal that somehow you think everyone else thinks is their favorite metal as well.
It is Australia's favorite metal. It is our major export.
It is the budget's favorite metal, put it that way.
We have got tons and tons of it, megatons of it, and it's a very important part of the economy. It was over $94 a ton not that long ago.
I think late last year.
And now it's started to fall.
Yeah.
And it's started to fall pretty hard, actually. So that's got implications, obviously, for the miners on the share market and also for the economy and the budget, et cetera, et cetera. Is this something that's just normal, a part of the normal vicissitudes of commodity pricing, or is this something, or are we getting to that lovely phrase, the new normal?
Can you spell vicissitudes?
No.
Okay. So the iron ore story is a funny one. This is,
you can barely say it.
This is the problem with, oh God, because we're running out of time, I'm not going to have a big rant.
Okay.
Here's the thing. When it costs you $25 to dig a ton of iron ore out of the ground and get it on a ship,
mm-hmm.
and when it's selling for $90,
yep.
you're making a lot of money.
Right.
And anybody else with a shovel and a bit of land
is
going to dig up the iron ore as well.
Yeah, of course.
And so,
even if they're doing it at $70 cost.
Right,
you know,
right. And so,
still money.
And that's exactly what's going to happen. Mm. So this is, honestly, I've never looked into it, but I'm not an options trader or a shorter, but every time the iron ore price gets to some sort of stupid level, the maths of it says it can't possibly last. It's people, it's traders trying to bet on what might happen next in the very, very short term.
Yeah.
The reality is that with any commodity product like iron ore, like anything else, airline seats, the price of the thing we're talking about, the product, will fall to roughly the marginal cost of production plus a bit.
Yep.
If the average cost of getting that iron ore out of the ground across the world is $35 a ton, and you can supply all of the world's needs without pushing your costs above that, the price will move back towards that, plus a little bit extra for some sort of investment return.
Yeah.
So maybe it's $40 a ton, $45 a ton.
Mm.
When it's $95 a ton, if you're buying the miners or you're buying iron ore at that sort of price, you are barking mad.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not surprised it's fallen. It deserves to fall. It always will do. Mm. These things do revert to the mean. They revert to close to the cost of production.
Mm.
It just makes... If you sell Coke, you can sell Coke at more than the average soft drink because it has something different about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a brand, a flavor, a taste, an aspiration, right?
That makes
you can... Right.
Yep.
Coke is life, all that sort of good stuff.
Yeah.
you can charge more for it.
Obesity, when you're selling... diabetes. Okay.
When you're selling the same ton of iron ore that you're selling, the same ton that I'm selling,
that
Jack over there, that Jill over there are selling, it's a ton of iron ore. It costs the same. It does the same thing. It goes on the same ship. You can't get a premium for it. And so it just makes no sense. If I can get Fortescue mining at the mid-teens per ton, and you're selling for 90, good on them. They bloody well deserve getting whatever money they can get. But there's no reason why the iron ore price should be anywhere near, it probably should have a four in front of four. Yeah, 40, 45,
so further
50
to fall,
maybe.
Further to fall, yeah.
Well, here's the thing, it should, right? Markets can do stupid things for a very long time.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no reason why anyone should expect the iron ore price to stay above $50 over the long term.
Yeah. Okay. We better wrap it up there. We're out of time. Thank you again, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Page.
Always a pleasure.
Very formal.
Don't forget that you can subscribe to Triple M Motley Fool Money through your favorite Android podcast app or through iTunes as well.
And you should.
And please give us a nice rating if you would be so kind.
Leave us a comment. Say some nice things.
Yes. And anyone who wants to say anything nasty, well, I guess you could do that too. What am I saying?
I'm not sure. Look, all news is good news.
Take a
apparently.
Hike.
Yeah,
if you're going to do that, take a hike.
If you hate,
get out.
If you hate listening to us, keep doing it by all means. We like the numbers, but don't tell anybody else.
And that's how you alienate your audience. Until next time, full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.